Do you you have three members? You're expecting your other members?
Yes.
Okay. And this we're calling to order the conference committee for the energy policy omnibus bill, Senate File 145. We don't have a full complement of members here presently, but they will be filtering in as we get started. And we will begin by starting with a side-by-side. And first of all, I'd like to thank everybody who has worked so hard to bring us to this point. I think that both sides have worked very, very hard, and we want to continue to honor everybody's work here and make sure that we listen to one another, be respectful of one another, and move forward in the open manner that we have all started out with and continue that process. So we will start by just familiarizing the members with the side-by-side comparison, which is Senate File 145 and House File. What's your House File number?
436.
Okay, unofficial engrossment of 145, which also includes the energy bill, which was a separate file, but was part of the House omnibus bill. And who's going to start?
I am.
Mr. Fuller will start by walking us through.
Thank you. Good morning. In the side-by-side, and it's not available now, I apologize for that, it'll come in later, the House Article 1 was not included by the reviser, and that was an omission. So we'll talk about that later when the House is going to bring in some copies. So we'll start with page 1 of the side-by-side, and that's the amendments to the SIP, Conservation Investment Program-related amendments, decoupling, and some miscellaneous amendments. Representative Kalin and Senator Dibble and the department and the stakeholders have worked on this, and there's almost, I think there's agreement on almost everything. There are a few minor differences, which there's a side-by-side. I don't think I'll dwell on those because they were basically the result of the House acting on this issue later than we did and getting more current information on areas that were not all that significant. And I believe the authors have come to grips with the stylistic and the few word differences. So with that in mind, go through the side-by-side on R1. I'll go through the House side, but they're pretty identical because we're going to end up adopting most of the House language with respect to differences. The first one is notice. This has to do, Dakota Electric is one of the only, is the only co-op that's elected to be regulated. There's two provisions in the bill that address their particular circumstance and make it more efficient for them to do their SIP planning. And this, the first one is this. First to 139, a filing utility subject to rate regulation, that's Dakota Electric. And this is a provision that they've asked for and people have agreed so that their unique status can be accommodated by the rates. Section 2 is, again, in the rate section of the electric utility, 216B16 is the rate regulation part of it. And this deals with recovery for costs on conservation investment improvements. I think there's two... There's a new concept that you'll find in the bill. It's called large energy facility. That's a gas-fired power plant, and they're carved out from the SIP program, as were other large facilities for electric earlier. And this section accommodates that notion. Several other sections accommodate that notion. And then you'll see on 4.13 on the House side, investment and expenses of a public utility should not include electric utility infrastructure costs. This is a new concept that you'll see in the next section. Infrastructure costs are, so if we go to section, we go to 4.15, and you'll see there's a new concept called electric utility infrastructure costs. This evolved from the concern of utilities. They may do activities with their owned infrastructure, which would result in savings of energy through efficiencies in their system, And it wasn't going to be accommodated or accounted, or we're going to get credit for it in the SIP program. So there, this notion was developed, and there's special treatment as you go through the bill. But that's the issue. And it's a process that will be regulated by the PUC. They'll review these projects and make sure there isn't double recovery. But it's part of the notion that we're going to encourage conservation in all aspects, and this is one aspect that was brought forward during the development of this bill. On page R4, energy conservation policy goal, it says what it says. It states a goal to the state would have annual energy savings equal to 1.5% of annual retail energy sales of electricity and natural gas. Both sides are agreeing. I think another one of the principles of this bill, this part of the bill, this article, is to invigorate the conservation efforts by the state, and this is a part of that strategy. Section 5 is a very long section. It is the SIP program, and there's more language here than needed to be. There's some parts that aren't amended. Much of what was amended was done to accommodate the new provision, with the important provision is under previous law, existing law, SIP mandates expenditures. That notion was retained, but a new notion, the notion of goals for energy investments, which was always there, was clarified and invigorated, and these amendments accommodate that and other technical issues that the department brought forward. So we have some new definitions. Gross annual, you'll see on 6.23, gross annual retail energy sales. That's the yardstick against which we measure the energy savings goals. And turn on some other definitions. You'll see on 7.17 on R5. There's sort of two new issues that were brought to the table by the industry with respect to the conservation program and getting credit for activities. One was the infrastructure utility, EUIC, electric utility infrastructure costs, and the other was this waste heat recovery notion where there would be capture of waste energy and it would be used in a way it would be, more efficiently and for other purposes. And so this is the definition of that term. It can count towards your SIP at a certain level. Other language that deals with it, again, relates to cost recovery and prevention of double recovery. So those are sort of the two new conservation notions that infiltrate this bill, the waste heat recovery system and the electric utility infrastructure costs. On R6, these are technical amendments. A lot of the strikeout language is due to the fact that we have some new policy. It accommodates that new policy on assessing for certain activities, new organization of a low-income program. It has a separate area now. So the strikeouts basically accommodate that. You'll see on R7, 9.10, we have a new threshold above which a municipality has some SIP obligations. It was a dollar value previously, but with the volatility of the price of the fuel, people could blink on and off, so a volumetric description was seen to be more appropriate and more stable. 9.28, you'll see the large energy facility again. Those are the gas-fueled power plants that are not part of the SIP program. They're carved off. You can't really have efficiencies with that. I mean, that's the thought anyway. On R8, again, strikeouts just accommodate the change on 10.16 and 19. The more frequent the filings now because of the new obligations to have savings. You see a few different filing requirements to accommodate the new obligation on the savings goal. On R9, the language on 11.15 and 11.17 carries forward a particular investment by a particular utility, I believe somewhere in the rural area, where they can make investments to refurbish a district heating or cooling plant, and that will count towards some of their SIP obligation. It does expire. It basically extends it and modifies it. 11.18 instructs the Commissioner of Commerce to consider suggestions by outside sources with respect to a utilities conservation investments. That was desired by the advocates. And then 1C is the meat and potatoes of this proposal. You'll see on, so energy saving goals, as you'll see, there was existing law on 11.22 that, you know, required the establishment of goals, and this invigorates it and makes it more specific. So 11.25 to 11.28, see the goal is 1.5% of gross annual retail energy sales, which is the defined term, which we looked at earlier. And it's going to be based, your goals will be based on a three-year rolling average so that distortions are accommodated. Then you'll see there's a filing schedule that must be adopted on 11:30 so that everybody's on board with these plans by 2010. These things take a while to implement and to get figured out. On 11.31 to 12.7 is the issue of the ability to file for a plan up to no less than 1%. And so there's that flexibility. It's a factual objective test. They come in and say, you know, here's our ability and here's the reason for not doing it, and the commission makes a decision. Again, there's no penalty for not meeting the goal, although there'll be lists published of how people are doing. So it's a best efforts sort of thing with some directive. Above 1.0, some things can be counted that couldn't be counted before below 1.0, including this issue of EUIC, electric utility infrastructure costs. You'll see on 12.8 that an energy saving goal is not satisfied by attaining the revenue expenditure requirements. So the old standards, that doesn't do it. You have their independent obligations. On R10, it provides that you don't have to spend if it's not cost effective in any event. So in any event, the investments have to be cost effective.
I haven't seen this yet.
That supersedes any other obligation. And you'll see on 12.18 to 12.23, that's where the commissioner is going to keep track of the performance under this goal provision and publish that information. And then on 12.24 to 26, there's an instruction to the Commissioner of Commerce that in approximately 3 years, he'll come back and inform the legislature whether the spending goals are still a requirement or not, or are still necessary, I should say. Okay, and then this is all in the SIP statute. Also, this is we're amending the SIP statute. There's a couple of subdivisions that provide for assessment authority against utilities to carry out various activities. On line 12.27 is the first of those three, and it has to do with technical assistance. The commissioner, the department's going to be much more hands-on, going to develop an inventory of projects that are cost-effective and energy-saving have enough instructions that you can implement them. So while it's not prescriptive, there'll be much more information flowing from the department to utilities is the thought. You can see the level of assessment on 13.13 on R10 and on R11 at the top of the page, 13.14. So it's 800,000 dropping to 450,000 for fiscal year 2010 and thereafter. These assessments are outside any limits, so they will not be limited by existing statutory provisions that have a limit on the absolute amount that can be assessed for regulatory activities. The second assessment is on 13.19, applied research and development grants. You'll see on 13.25, that's $3.6 million annually. Therefore, identifying new technologies or strategies to maximize energy savings, improve the effectiveness of energy conservation programs. So it's basically an underlying R&D program to support wise investments in the SIP program. Then the third assessment is on 13.30, Facilities energy efficiencies. Buildings are a big energy user. The state has some existing programs. This provides an assessment authority to keep those programs going and to help private commercial buildings achieve higher levels of energy efficiency. There's a goal, as you'll see on line 14.6 to 14.8. State goal is to achieve certification of 1,000 commercial buildings as Energy Star labeled, and 100 commercial buildings is LEED certified. LEED's a program of standards for buildings to become more energy efficient and conserve energy by December 31st, 2010. And the assessment level is on 14.9, $500,000. On R12, you'll see on 14.19, we have more frequent filings of plans, SIP plans by subject utilities. Strikeout is consistent with the philosophy of not prescribing particular programs. You'll see on line 15.7 again, the large energy facility, which is a gas-fueled power plant, is exempted. Strikeout our language at the bottom of the page. And going on to the top of R13 are to accommodate changes in the underlying program and the fact that the low-income program is moved to another section of the statute, so it's not eliminated, it's moved. Down at 16.13 is language is just dresses up the account where these assessments are going to, makes it consistent with the financial nomenclature. And
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dibble.
Our book is missing R13, so if we could stop for a second and get those copies to us so we can follow along.
Yeah, he's got it.
Did you?
Well, some are.
We have it.
Okay.
Is there only one book that's missing there?
Two books.
So we need several copies of 13.
It's the hockey page.
13?
13.
What'd you bury in there?
Copies of that page.
Who has to tell you, but.
Got to kill him.
That's right.
Can we continue?
Sure. And then we'll get it back.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I think the audience is missing it, too, so if they're following along.
Let me go back to R13 and be exhaustive on R13 then. We have a repealer of some low-income language program, which is put somewhere else in the statute. We have a strikeout of ability to do program evaluations, pre-evaluations. That's now considered to be part of this assessment can be used for that. And then the only other language has to do with the energy and conservation account and making clear what the account is, where it's located, what the money can be used for, and appropriating it to the Commissioner of Commerce. And then there's language stricken on that page having to do with the low-income program, and it's moved to later on. I think it's subdivision 7, later in the same section. And then on R14, you'll see on 17.1, recovery of expenses. There's some technical changes, but this again is Dakota Electric, which is the one utility that's a cooperative that has elected to be rate regulated, and that has caused them some difficulties in expense that are because of certain inefficiencies with the statutory language, and this accommodates them. In no way changes their obligation. On 17.24, there are incentive programs, and now with the new goals, there's a concern that, you know, what's the appropriate incentive with respect to the goals? And so this language requires the commissioner to look at those incentive plans and adjust them accordingly, including based on best efforts, because there are people who are doing a good job but maybe not being able to meet the goals for the fact that there just aren't investments available at this time, or they're not geared up, or for whatever reason, or technology isn't available. You go to, don't see any changes on R15. These are just subdivisions that were included, that were in that section. They weren't amended. You go to R16, there's the low-income program language I referenced earlier. This is language that was worked on actually for several years with all the parties, including the low-income advocates, and there's agreement. It does require an obligation to expend some money on low-income persons, including renters, and the level is set against a benchmark that includes residential energy use. At the bottom of the page, the new subdivision 8 on R17 makes it clear that the assessments are proportionate to a utility share of the gross revenue. So it's a revenue proportionate assessment for those assessments that we discussed earlier. Turn to page R18.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dibble.
I just thought I'd add on the low-income piece. It gives utilities the option of carrying out these programs themselves or contributing to a fund that then the department would undertake these activities.
Thank you.
R18 is the section 6 on 21.1. That's what's commonly called decoupling, which is a strategy to address the concern that utilities under our current rate structure don't have an incentive to conserve because their volume sales go down, their revenue goes down. So it asks the commission to, by order, establish criteria and standards for a decoupling program and authorizes but does not require utilities to engage in a pilot program that can last for 3 years unless it's approved in the general rate case. My understanding is that the gas utilities are much interested in this sort of notion, I assume, partly because of the volatility of the weather and for other reasons as well. But it is it's an authorization and not a requirement. On 21.23, State Government Energy Savings Plan, I believe the Senate does have the same language in another section of the bill, identical. It requires the state to make efforts and to identify, on line 21.27, identify policy options, barriers, and economic benefits and costs for state government operations to achieve the energy savings goals. That's provided in the language that you don't have in front of you, and the resulting carbon emissions reductions. So it's, again, trying to invigorate the state's effort to be a player in this conservation program. The revisers' instruction, apparently they detected an error and thought it was the most efficient way to deal with it was just to tell them to fix it rather than to do it statutorily, and it is an error. We have the same effective date. So that's the energy article, the SIP program, the Senate file 997, Representative Kalin's bill. And I don't know if you wanted to say something.
Oh, there's just one additional thing.
There's Article 2. I was going to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Right. But that's the meat of the – then Article 2, beginning on R19, is labeled miscellaneous, and it's basically inserting the Department of Commerce as a recipient of information under various activities by units of government. So Section 1, if you'll see on 22.29, if there's an energy savings plan by a school district, the school board must provide a copy of the contract to the Commissioner of Commerce, 22.29, 22.31. And then you'll see on the left side there that language that in the House was back on page R18, 21.23. So it just appeared in different articles, but it's the same language. On page R20, there is a House provision that I think first appeared in the Environment Appropriations Bill having to do with information from Manitoba concerning Manitoba Hydro. And this House proposal amends that language on 23.11. There's nothing in this section shall be construed as a directive to the Government of Canada or the Province of Manitoba. And there is no There's no provision in the Senate that's comparable to this. On Section 3, Energy Audit Programs, this is the Department of Commerce program. It deletes most of the language, but makes it clear that training qualified people to do the auditing is a primary goal of the Department of Commerce. By the way, the language is identical on both sides. On Section 4 on R21, these are municipal energy savings contracts, and it's the same sort of provision as with Section 1. You'll see on R22, it's a long section, 25.20. If they're entering into a guaranteed energy savings contract, a copy and a report shall be given to the Commissioner of Commerce. They want to be in the knowledge loop on these contracts. On R23, this is did I miss one? No, this is a landlord and tenant. It reorganizes some existing obligations of a landlord in a residential lease with respect to energy efficiency activities and clarifies that obligation. Adds some language that relates to cost effectiveness, as you'll see on 26.6 to 26.7. And that strikeout language has basically been moved up and reworded. The language on 26.9 and 26.10 is very similar with the new language. And then both sides have a repealer that has to do with the residential energy programs and energy audits and rental buildings at the Department of Commerce, and they're identical. And then on page R24, there's Section 7, nuclear energy study. Basically, a provision that says compare nuclear energy to other options with respect to cost. Ask the Electric Energy Task Force to engage in that activity. It has a number of criteria by which have to be satisfied or obligations with respect to the study. And a report back March of next year of 08. And effective dates are the same. So, and the Senate has no comparable provision. I believe there is a bill introduced in the Senate that was not acted on that had some of the same thought. That's the end of Senate File 997 and the House companion language, which was incorporated in the House version of Senate File 155.
Before we move on to the seabed languages, are there any questions or any obvious concerns about the language that we've gone over? Thank you to the two authors. And Mr. Eliff is going to continue with the seabed language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The seabed language begins on page R25. And one of the major changes to the seabed program this year is to expand it from a program that applied only to wind energy projects to all renewable energy projects, using the definition of renewable that's in the RES statute, which was passed earlier this session. Section 1 in both versions is identical. It essentially makes that change from establishing a seabed tariff for renewable energies as a whole rather than just wind. Section 2 in the Senate and Subdivision 2 in the House language are definitions of seabed projects, and the changes made on page R25 are identical. They include allowing a cooperative association to be a member of a seabed project on behalf of or the request of a member distribution utility. Same thing is allowed with respect to a municipal electricity provider. On R26, the definition of seabed continues, and there are some differences in the language in the House and the Senate proposals. The Senate proposals on lines 221 to 223 provide that a seabed project can either be a standalone project or as part of a partnership under a later subdivision. That language is not present in the House. On the House side, looking at lines 29.4 through 29.17, it makes a change in the definition of a seabed project with respect to how the proceeds of that project flow to, in the Senate, you'll see the 51% flows to qualifying owners, which is the current statute. In the House, the 51% flows to a number of different entities, qualifying owners who must receive no less than 35% from the power purchase agreement. But included in the 51% is also revenues flowing to owners of land upon which the project is sited in the form of easement or lease payments. Also includes taxes paid, wind taxes, wind production taxes paid to local units of government, and project debt for the seabed projects to state chartered lenders. So there's the major difference in that definition. On page R27, in the middle of the page on the House side, subdivision 4 indicates that the new tariff must be filed, the new seabed tariff must be filed with the Public Utilities Commission by December 1st, 2007, and there's no comparable language on the House side. Referring to the provision just above that, subdivision 3 in the House and section 3 in the Senate tariff rate, that is identical in both versions. It removes the 2.7 cents per kilowatt hour cap that has been that's currently imposed on seabed projects. That cap is now removed. At the bottom of the page, subdivision 5 in the Senate and the House, priority for seabed projects. This section talks about the relationship between seabed projects and the renewable energy standard. On line 30.7 in the House language, it indicates that a utility that is constructing new generation or purchasing output from new generation as part of its standard obligation under the RES law must take reasonable steps to determine if a seabed project is available that can meet the utility's cost and reliability requirements. The Senate language retains the current statutory language that a utility should take the reasonable steps to determine that. A little further down on lines 30.11 to 30.15 on the House language, it calls on a utility that has filed a renewable energy plan to negotiate in good faith with developers of seabed projects whose aggregated capacity is equal to the capacity of seabed projects that the utility identifies in its plan that it will be purchasing. On page R28, at the top of the page in the House language, provides that a municipal power agency or a generation and transmission cooperative, when it issues requests for proposals for seabed projects to satisfy its standard obligation under the RES statute, that it can propose that it provide notice to its member distribution utilities that they can become involved and propose projects in partnership with seabed developers to meet that RES requirement. Subdivision 7 in the House language in the middle of that page, again, changes the word wind to renewable to reflect the broadening of the definition of seabed. Subdivision 8 at the bottom of the page in both the House and the Senate allows utilities or an independent power producer to participate in a seabed project as owner, equity partner, or provider of technical or financial assistance. On page R29, the House includes a number of provisions that are not in the Senate language. At the top in subdivision 9, the language allows a developer of a proposed seabed project to request the Commissioner of Commerce to issue an advisory opinion as to whether that project does indeed qualify as a seabed project. Section 3 talks about utility ownership of renewable resources and says that essentially this is applying to Xcel Energy, which is required to submit a plan to the Public Utilities Commission that outlines how they are going to fulfill the renewable energy standard obligation, and how exactly seabed projects and non-seabed projects fit into that. They must provide a proposed schedule of acquisitions and constructions of generation facilities, expected in-service dates, and also proposed transmission sources that are associated with bringing those facilities to market. The plan is also required to contain alternative means of providing that energy and compares costs between the proposed projects and those alternative means. And the language at the bottom of the page reflects how the commission can approve that plan after public hearing. The language continues on page R30 in the House version. Subdivision or section 4 at the top allows for cost recovery of owned renewable facilities, much as Mr. Fuller mentioned earlier. This is a way for utilities to recover costs more quickly directly from ratepayers rather than going through a rate case. This provision allows them to do that for renewable energy facilities that they own, and the provision specifies how that comes about and the procedure that utilities need to follow at the commission in order for that to happen. On page R31, at the top of the page, section 5 calls on the commission to begin a review of curtailment payments for wind energy projects. There have been reports that utilities may be discriminating against different project ownership structures in regard to whether in contracts with project developers, curtailment payments are available for those times when the utility can't take wind. This would instruct the Public Utilities Commission to investigate that beginning by September 1st of later this year. Section 6 on page R31 establishes a community-based green pricing option. You may recall that green pricing has is currently part of Minnesota statutes with respect to renewable energy. The RES law that was passed earlier this session essentially had that provision expire in January of 2010. This is a very similar provision for seabed projects only. It would allow customers who want to own or want their electricity to come from a higher proportion of seabed projects.
Mr. Eliff,
yes,
we're going to have to recess. The House needs to go in to vote. So we will take... We'll come back at 11:30.